Hello and welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode. Tom, you're dialing in from Greece, aren't you? Very exciting.
I am. I'm at the Kardemeli Literary Festival, which is a wonderful bash, and I'm staying in the house of Patrick Leifermer. Is he great? I'm not sure he is great, but he was an all right writer about Greece.
Who's better than all right, Tom?
Yeah, he is better than all right. I think his prose style is slightly out of fashion now. Slightly lush.
Like Jan Morris.
A little bit like Jan Morris, yeah.
Yeah, Jan Morris's book on Venice, which I had to abandon for being overwritten.
Yeah, Paddy Leifermer was very, very much like that. But who am I to diss him? Because his villa is absolutely gorgeous and I'm staying here and it's very nice.
So Patrick Leifermer had an amazing life, didn't he? He kidnapped a German general on Crete.
Well, first of all, he walked across Europe in whatever, 1936 or something, 1937.
He did.
Almost penniless, camping out with bears in Romanian woods and things like that. And then he ended up in Greece.
Although actually...
Is that not true?
Tom, he stays at a succession of the chateau of kind of old Etonian counts in Transylvania that he's got contacts with. So actually, when you read that book within a particular mood,
right,
you know, you just kind of think 99%, 0.9% of the population could not do this.
Well, it's full of things kind of... I had a quiet picnic, just a few people. The Queen of Romania was there.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a very modest affair.
Exactly.
But then he does go on. He's incredibly brave and he fights as a partisan in Crete and he captures a German general, as you said.
But he was subsequently very poorly behaved, I think it's fair to say, in the post-war years when he lived in Kardemeli, where you are now, in the house you're in right now, Tom.
Yes, it's like Tiberius's villa.
Yeah. And he would take regular trips. This is what a detail I remember from the biography. To Athens to visit prostitutes all the time. And he would come back and give his wife gonorrhea.
Charming.
So I hope you're not behaving similarly.
Of course not. I'm spending my time reading about Napoleon, Dominic, as you well know.
Very good. I do know, yes.
Which is obviously going to be the theme of an upcoming subject, isn't it?
Well, we're going to do two episodes, I think, on Napoleon, aren't we? Young Napoleon.
Yes. So Churchill and Napoleon will be biographical subjects whose entire lives in due course, hopefully, we'll get to do.
Yeah, that's true.
We've done young Churchill, haven't we? Now we're going to do young Napoleon.
Yeah.
But God, I mean, there's so much Napoleon, isn't there?
I think Napoleon will run to...
Hundreds of episodes. All those battles.
I'm thinking we'll get to the point where he commands the army of Italy, but he hasn't gone to Italy yet. Because there's so much going on in Corsica and Toulon.
Because he's delayed, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's an hour late for his own wedding because he's just been given command of the army that's going to attack Italy.
Yeah.
So that's a good moment.
He's poring over maps and things, isn't he? And then he turns up, he lies about, don't they both lie about their age at their wedding?
They do. So Napoleon raises his and Josephine, who's quite elderly by this point, lowers hers. And also she has her black teeth.
Her black teeth and the practice known as the zigzag. Have you read about that, Tom?
Yes. Yes, I have. And the mystery as to what a zigzag is by which she captivates the young and inexperienced Napoleon. And also the interesting name for her private parts.
What's that?
Napoleon calls her private parts the Baron de Goubin or something like that. And nobody knows why.
That's, yeah.
Or who the Baron is.
That's very peculiar.
Anyway, but this can all be discussed.
Okay. But Tom, before we get started on the questions, am I right in thinking that you have, very uncharacteristically, been contemplating yourself a great deal in recent days?
I have, Dominic, I have. And I just want to give a shout out to a wonderful company because listeners will know that we're not normally given to embarrassing adverts, are we?
Never.
I mean, we don't do them at all. No, but we are unapologetically a capitalist show. I mean, we approve of that. We have no problem with excellent companies selling their wares. And so it was that I was approached by a very good company called yourtour.live, which... Basically, they get a genealogist to research your family.
Yeah.
And then they give you all the bump. And so you don't have to do it yourself. And it's interesting. Have you ever had any interest in researching your family, where they come from?
Not really, but members of my family on both sides have done it. So sort of uncles and things and aunts have researched. But I've never, I think because there's only so many kind of Bilston, Black Country puddlers that I can read about before my eyes glaze over a little bit, Tom.
Yeah, I've also kind of thought it was slightly odd, considering how interested I am in history, that I've never actually bothered looking at my own family history.
Yeah.
I mean, I did know, I've got an ancestor who ran a pub on the Isle of Wight and hung out with Tennyson.
Okay, that's quite good.
And it turned out, as a result of this genealogist, who was excellent, hung out with somebody called the Emperor Napoleon. So I don't know which Napoleon that is, whether it was Napoleon III.
I mean, say hung out with.
Well, the Emperor Napoleon, whoever this was, came to stay in his pub, his hotel.
Are you sure the Emperor Napoleon wasn't like either a music hall high wire act or a prize pig or something of that kind?
Yeah, I don't think it would be a prize pig because it was quite a classy joint.
Right.
Because I don't think Tennyson would be hanging out in a hotel with a
prize pig.
A pig.
Okay.
So I don't know who that is, but that's kind of interesting field for future research. But on my father's side, because you know that I'm very proud to come from Staffordshire, from Stoke.
Yes, when you're not talking about Wiltshire, you claim other origins.
But it turns out, actually, that we come from Derbyshire.
Oh.
And also that I shouldn't really be called Holland, because my great-great-great-whatever-it-is grandfather...
It's called Belgium.
...was the illegitimate son of a housemaid.
Okay.
So didn't know who the father was. And so the housemaid's name was Holland. So that's where it came from.
Tom, none of this surprises me.
Her father was a dodgy shopkeeper in Derbyshire who was convicted for dodgy weights, things like that. So he had to chuck it in.
Whereabouts in Derbyshire?
I've already forgotten.
You've already forgotten?
But it's somewhere in Derbyshire. And he was disgraced and had to go and become a coal miner in Staffordshire.
Okay.
So that was very sad.
Great anecdote.
Yeah, great anecdote. And she can trace it all the way back to 1664.
I think there's something fundamentally un-English about researching your family history.
Why do you think that, Dominic?
Because I think English people tend to be very complacent about where we've come from. So we just sort of take it for granted. I tell you what I think it is very American. So Americans love researching their family histories.
Dominic, I'm not sure that's true. I think that upwardly mobile people researching their genealogies in the hope of discovering some kind of aristocratic forebear is a staple theme of English social comedy.
I think so. I think it's un-English.
I mean, it regularly features in 19th century novels.
Does it? Does it happen in Bleak House?
Yeah, it does.
I suppose Bleak House is all the business about.
The whole thing about Bleak House is about.
Yeah, yeah. What an example to have chosen.
Yeah. I mean, kind of lost wills and illegitimate children and people migrating to coal mines.
Fine, it happens all the time. Happens all the time.
Yeah, it does. It does.
I mean, they're not doing, it's not like Ancestry.com is piling into Bleak House and they're, you know, faffing around over housemaids in Derbyshire in the early 19th century,
Knows? I mean, there may be some lost will and maybe this housemaid is. Maybe I'm the descended from the Duke of Rutland or something. I mean, I don't know.
Do you know what all this proves? You've wasted so much of your life watching Downton Abbey. That's exactly what this proves.
No, or reading Dickens.
Okay.
Anyway, should we move on and answer some questions?
There's a whole load of questions about fascism, but before we do that, I'd like to ask you a question.
Oh, yeah.
From South Texas Wang, what are your thoughts about the debacle with the Sycamore Gap tree last week? Now, some people will think, what is this? I'll tell you, a tree was cut down near Hadrian's Wall.
Well, right next to Hadrian's Wall.
Tom, it was a great story in Britain. All sorts of weeping and wailing about it. Very sad scenes. I've never seen the tree and I'm not from Northumberland. So I'd be lying. I'd be affecting.
Couldn't care.
I don't care. I'm sad the tree's been cut down because I do like a tree. But I'd be lying if I said I gave it more than 2 seconds thought. But Tom, I know this is the kind of thing you would care about.
It has a certain degree of international fame because it appeared in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
It did.
When Kevin Costner lands, I think, by the White Cliffs of Dover, goes to Hadrian's Wall and then arrives in Nottingham and is famously... it's the most stupid journey in medieval England. I obviously was very upset by it. It's a very, very striking landmark. Anyone who's walked the wall, as I have done three times, would be familiar with it. It's just along from Housesteads, the most famous stretch of the wall. And the wall bends down, forms a kind of very small valley, and the tree is at the center of this low point. So very striking.
Yeah.
And it just seems so pointless. I mean, I can't see what the point would be of chopping it down. It seems...
That's a headmaster talking to the boys. It was just a pointless act of vandalism, boys, because that's literally what it was. It was a pointless act of vandalism, wasn't it?
Well, or was it the land is owned by the Jesuits, weirdly? I mean, who knew? And maybe there's some theological battle going on. Maybe it's striking a blow for the Protestant succession or something. I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Seems very unlikely.
It does. But I was upset, Dominic.
Yeah.
I think the destruction of a much-loved landmark, I don't think I've been as upset about that since the fire at Notre Dame.
What, you don't care about the Crooked House pub in the Black Country?
I do quite care about the Crooked House pub, but I haven't been to that. But I have been to Notre Dame and I have seen the tree.
Talking of destructions of landmarks, one bit of good news last week was the announcement that the government is going to cancel the northern leg of HS2. They're freeing up capacity, Tom, to build the Stonehenge Tunnel, which is quite nice.
Yeah, I know. So... yeah.
I thought you'd like that.
My vote, which was completely up for grabs, says they've lost it.
Okay, let's do some proper questions. Let me ask you another question from Dan. Dan wants to know, what was the most effective act of censorship in history? Most effective act of censorship. That's a really good question.
What's your answer to that, Dominic? Because obviously I have a brilliant answer. But just let you go first.
It'll be something religious, won't it? It'll be something, some lost gospel or something like that.
Well, according to tradition, yeah, the first emperor of China destroys all the books in China. So if there is any historical basis to that, I guess that would be it.
Joe, you know, I've thought of one now that you've mentioned the emperor of China. See, this is the effect you have on me, Tom. You spark interesting thoughts.
Well, that's what we're all about on this podcast, isn't it?
So we did a podcast, which hasn't yet come out, a whole series about the fall of the Aztecs that have been in my mind, and also my book, The Fall of the Aztecs, is coming out. And the Mexica.
Oh, the bishop, the guy who burnt all the Mayan stuff.
No, I wasn't thinking of that.
The guy who wrote about Atlantis as well.
There is a guy who burns all the Mayan stuff. Also, the Spaniards burned, when they captured the city of Texcoco, they burn a lot of illustrated books, because that was a thing that people in Mesoamerica used to do a lot. You'd beat your enemies, you'd conquer their city or whatever, and then you would burn their books to destroy their history. But there is a guy called, I think his name is Tlacael, I can't remember his name, but I think it's that. He is like a power behind the throne about 100 years before the Spanish conquest. And he has the idea. He says, after the Mexica have won all these wars and become the great paramount power in the Valley of Mexico, he says, instead of burning everybody else's books, I mean, obviously we should do that, but we should burn our old books and our old histories as well, because we'll be able to construct an entirely new history for ourselves, showing how we were always a chosen people, how we were always special and imperial people. We weren't downtrodden vassals. So they reinvented their own history. They censored their own history, Tom, in order to create a new imperial identity for themselves. And they literally burned the old books. So there's your act of censorship. I mean, I suppose all imperial powers, you could argue, forge their own history, don't they? But whether they literally burn the old histories is an interesting question.
I mean, according to legend, that is very much what the first emperor of China is about.
Okay.
He wants himself to be the wellspring of everything that people remember. So everything that precedes him has to go. I mean, I think it definitely has the quality, probably, of folk tale. I don't know enough about the first emperor of China to know how historically based it is.
It's a good story. That's a good story.
I mean, it'd be a good theme. I would love to do the first emperor of China. So let's aim to do that at some point. I mean, you talked about empires destroying the texts of their enemies. The Romans do that with Carthage.
Yeah.
They deliberately burn all the Punic books, and the only thing that they spare is a guide to agronomy.
Is that true? That's a good fact. Tom, I would love you to do a series on Carthage. You know my views on this.
We are going to be doing it. You've given permission, so it will happen.
Permission. So because I'm feeling kind, I'm going to ask you another question, because this is right up your street.
Yeah?
It's from Klaz. Now that it is spooky season, the poet Byron aside, that's why I thought of you, Tom, who are history's most likely vampires? And I can think of no one better to ask than history's most famous vampire novelist.
Well, I having written a book in which Byron was a vampire, then found myself slightly just kind of stuck in a cul-de-sac where I had to think of other famous literary figures who might have been vampires.
Okay, that's good.
So I came up with Christopher Marlowe. So, you know, Shakespeare's contemporary, the great playwright who supposedly gets murdered in a brawl in Deptford. But what if he didn't?
So did you write a novel about that as well?
Yeah. It was set in the Restoration.
How come that one never gets the attention of your Byron vampire?
Because I don't think it was very good.
All right.
It's the honest answer. But so it was set in the Restoration. It featured John Aubrey, the great folklorist.
Yeah.
Who actually lived in Broadchurch.
I know, never been before mentioned on this podcast.
Well, so he's kind of rootling around trying to, you know, uncover these amazing facts. And he comes across the fact that Christopher Marlowe is a vampire, and the Earl of Rochester, the notorious rake and scabrous poet, favorite of Charles II, who's always falling out with him, he's a vampire. And Milton featured as well. And Milton gets the idea for Satan from hanging out with vampires.
Okay.
So classy stuff.
And where were you going to go after that? What was your next?
Well, the last in the series is set around Tutankhamun and Akhenaten.
Oh, yes.
And Akhenaten is a vampire because he looks quite like an alien.
Yeah, of course.
And in the novel, it turns out the vampires are actually descended from a line of aliens. Oh,
that's never been done before.
It's such a classy stuff.
So is Virginia Woolf a vampire? Could she have been a vampire, the Bloomsbury Group? They're very pallid and they're kind of...
I guess. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, she'd be a kind of... she would be a kind of modernist vampire, wouldn't she?
Modernist vampires.
She'd be slightly more kind of complex.
What about Lord Randolph Churchill? Is he a vampire? Do you think? With his syphilis or whatever it was?
Yeah, I mean, the complication is that they've got to plausibly escape death. So they can't have too public a funeral. There has to be a slight mystery around their death.
Oh, right. Rinka could be a vampire. Vampiric dog.
Rinka could be a vampire.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Nero is a vampire. What do you think?
Yeah, or Elagabalus.
Yeah, someone like that. Anyway, it's a great question. Klaus also asks, if you had to be haunted by the ghost of a famous historical figure, who would you pick?
To be haunted, it depends what they're doing, isn't it?
Well, you wouldn't want Virginia Woolf, would you?
No, that'd be awful.
She'd come up and complain about the servants.
But you can hear them and no one else can.
I don't know. Klaus hasn't specified.
You know, because although it would be amusing to hang out with Richard Nixon for an evening or something, or the Empress Theodora in non-corporeal form, it'd be annoying after if they're always there.
Theodora up to her tricks again.
Exactly. There's a wonderful book called The Ghost of Thomas Kemp. Have you ever read that? It's actually a children's book.
That vaguely rings a bell.
It's about a Jacobean ghost who comes back and he haunts this boy. And he just causes total chaos in this town. It's very amusing.
I do remember. Anyway. Yes, I do remember that. It's kind of the plot of Ghosts, isn't it?
It is the plot. Yeah, the plot of Ghosts.
The kind of horrible history spin-off where there's a house full of various ghosts.
Exactly.
I'd quite like to be haunted by a creepy boy, I think. I think that would be classy.
Well, Theo is asking, would you like to be haunted by Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk?
No, I wouldn't. No, that would just be awful. That would be like being kind of in a Devonshire at the Rugby World Cup or something.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
It would be my idea of hell.
A man in a rugby shirt, just
plastic
laughing
breasts.
Constantly.
Yeah. All of my 15.
Yeah.
But I think a creepy boy would be classy, possibly with a begging bowl or something like that.
Okay, let's do some more.
Okay, B. Panozzo. If The Rest Is History was tasked to do a deep dive, 20-ish part podcast series on a topic, what subject would we be most likely to agree to do? And B. Panozzo says most of his, her favorite episodes of the podcast are the multi-part deeper dives into subjects. So it'd be interested to hear how The Rest Is History would approach doing a series that would end up being of similar length to a short audiobook. Well, if that's what you like, it's your lucky day because we have our first 8-part series coming up, don't we? Which is Cortez and Moctezuma. That was tremendous.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the lives of Churchill and Napoleon, which we were talking about earlier, I mean, they will end up as kind of self-contained series. And we are going to be recording in maybe 3 or 4 weeks, 4 episodes on the halftime in the Hundred Years' War. So that's going to be the reigns of Richard II and Henry IV.
Yeah.
And then in due course, we will go on to do the second half of the Hundred Years' War. So that would be 12 episodes, wouldn't it?
It would. So we'll have done 12 episodes on the era of the Hundred Years' War certainly by this time next year, probably by next Easter, I would hope. We're hoping to do another 4 episodes on the Third Reich.
Yeah.
We are also hoping to do, at some stage, a really detailed series on the French Revolution, like proper narrative, blow by blow. I think it'd be fun to do a series on the Ptolemies.
Yeah.
Because they're such, you know, kind of crazy family, Tom.
Problem is they all slightly blur into one, don't they? They're all called Ptolemy and they're all called Cleopatra.
They do a tiny bit, but I think we could, with our wonderful narrative skills, we could bring them to life.
Weave a tale.
What I'd like to do, I would like to do the Alexander the Great's successors, and that could bleed into the Ptolemies, actually. So that's all one. That's a monster series.
Maybe that's how we do it.
Byzantium? I think that'd be brilliant. Massive history of Byzantium. That's the kind of thing that people in America do 72 episode podcasts about, isn't it? With small groups of listeners where it's a very sort of nerdy person.
Episode 38, right. Leo the Isaurian.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Listen to people who play a lot of strategy video games.
I mean, the thing is that we do 100 Years' War, then we could go on and do the Wars of the Roses.
We absolutely must.
And then we'd be into the Tudors. And we could end up doing an entire history of England.
We talked about that.
I mean, we could go backwards as well.
I am totally on for it. Basically, we've turned this bonus episode into a scheduling meeting.
I mean, listeners will get the sense of what it's like.
So I think we should absolutely do that, because I've always thought we should do the Tudors in proper deep dive.
Immersive.
And not just the kind of court politics, but the court politics and the theology and all the social stuff. That'd be a great subject. And then go on and do the Civil War, Tom.
Yeah.
Go into the 17th century and do that blow by blow.
But we could also go backwards and we could kind of do Roman Britain.
Listen, there is no end. There is no end to the rest of history.
So that by the time we finally hang up our spurs in 2053, we'll have done the whole history of England and possibly the history of France
the
as
world.
Well. And
I think the history
America
of the world.
And who knows?
Yeah. So that's our answer to B, Panozzo. I'm going to ask myself a question now because Theo has been asking you to ask it and you haven't. Caput Nili. If President Nixon called you into his office on the 18th of June, 1972, the day after the Watergate break-in, how would you have advised him to successfully navigate the situation and avoid the coming scandal? I think my answer to that, Caput Nili, is either you come out and you admit it straight away. That would be politically very damaging. You'd just have to take the hit and hope that you could ride it out. Or you pay off the burglars immediately. Like pay them large amounts of money to buy their silence.
That's more dangerous, isn't it? Because then they would just blackmail you.
It is more dangerous. I think you'd have to admit it. The problem with admitting it is you would be tempted to say, this is a one-off, I didn't know about it and all of that stuff, which might well have been true. But then the danger is that some of the subordinates say, well, this was actually part of a pattern of the president telling us to do dirty tricks and then you're in trouble. So maybe...
invent a time machine and not go back to
right,
time.
Right, and not do it. It, yeah. I think in a way you could argue there is no other... You know, Nixon actually does well to hang on as long as he does. That's a counterintuitive view, Tom. As most people always say, it's the cover-up that gets you. It's not just the cover-up. It's the fact that you've burgled the opposition headquarters.
You've done something that needs to be covered up.
Yes. Tom, I know you love peace, don't you? You love peace.
Yeah, I love peace. Yeah, all in favour of peace.
Ned in 1963 asks about Nobel Prizes. Who do you think have been the most and least worthy winners of the Nobel Prize for Peace over the years? Do you follow the Nobel Peace Prize closely?
I don't really, no.
You don't?
I kind of think of people who win the Peace Prize as being the kind of people that you hate.
That I hate or that one hates?
Yes, that you would hate.
Henry Kissinger won it, Tom? I don't hate Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that was a ridiculous award, to be fair.
He's famously held up as being the worst, isn't he?
Well, somebody said the satire was dead. Yeah.
Was it Christopher Hitchens said that?
No, it was somebody at the time. Barack Obama won it for being elected after his first election. That was the most ludicrous.
And he then started droning everybody, right. Didn't he? I mean, Barack Obama killed a lot of people with drones.
Did he?
He did.
Bill Clinton killed a lot of people with airstrikes.
Yeah. So, I mean, the difference with Bush was that Bush actually sent people in to kind of stare into the whites of eyes as they killed them.
Yeah.
But Obama, because he was the first guy who could use drones as agents of killing. I mean, he did them a lot. I mean, that was basically how he dealt with the Islamic State.
I mean, rather than personalize it in this way about presidents, we could actually, I mean, I think a better way of talking about it is actually to say the United States, because of its role in the world, the very act of being chief executive means the chances are that you will be ordering these things because of your engagement in the world's trouble spots. And doesn't necessarily make you a bad person.
I'm just going to go into the Bodleian and look up Nobel Peace Prize winners. So this is live research, ladies and gentlemen. I have to say, the Nobel Prizes, I'm not interested. I don't care, really.
This was the one thing I had to say about this question. I thought I was going to be a bracing, refreshing dose of common sense after your idealistic answer, but no. Because you've basically given the answer I would give, which is I don't care either. And I think the idea of a prize for peace is a complete and utter nonsense.
God, there are all kinds of people I've never heard of. Have you heard of William Randall Creamer? He was given for his long-standing and devoted effort in favour of the ideas of peace and arbitration.
However, Tom, I'll tell you one person who won it.
Theodore Roosevelt won it.
That's bonkers.
Oh, that's insane. Yeah. That's absolutely insane.
Austin Chamberlain won it. Joseph Chamberlain's son, Neville Chamberlain's brother. He won it in the 1920s.
Do you know who...
Don't tell me, the Kaiser.
No, Woodrow Wilson won it for his role as founder of the League of Nations.
Oh, well, that went well.
That did go well. Yes, Austin Chamberlain won it for his crucial role in bringing about the Locarno Treaty.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is very boring for people.
Yeah, okay, stop reading out lists. So he wants us to do more questions.
Some of the more recent ones. I'm sure there were kind of people who cleared up mines or something, weren't there? I mean,
Yeah, there's all those kinds of things. I'm surprised Rory Stewart hasn't won it for something.
The World Food Programme.
Right.
I mean, that's good. Yeah, I go for them.
Okay.
Oh, the European Union. The European Union won it in 2012.
Oh, gosh. I think I probably wrote a column about that, Tom. Disobliging column, yeah. Okay, listen, I'm going to ask you a question.
Oh, Jimmy Carter won it in 2002.
Right.
For his decades of untiring effort to find peaceful solutions to international conflict. I think he's a worthy winner of that.
Same Gerald Ford never won it, to be fair. Theo is going mad that you are reading off lists.
Jimmy Carter was an impressive... I mean, he's been an impressive post-president, ex-president.
He has. People hate the fact that I'm down on Jimmy Carter. Cardigans, Theo has written in the chat, quite rightly. I'm very down on Jimmy Carter. I was very rude about him in my book. But I've also met Jimmy Carter and he was charm itself.
I know, Dominic, you've told that story. We can't go back to that. Okay, here's one from Fionn G. Which Prime Minister had the most influence after leaving office? Edward Heath campaigning for European Community membership must have had the biggest long-term impact.
No, not Ted Heath. Ted Heath tarnished his own brand by sulking so ostentatiously for so long. So I wouldn't say Ted Heath. Plus, the cause that he championed lost in the long run. Mm. I wouldn't pick him. I would say... Very few prime ministers have any impact at all after they leave office.
Say this case for Mrs. Thatcher?
The legend rather than the person. Maybe somebody like Arthur Balfour, the Balfour Declaration?
Yes, of course.
So I'd say probably Balfour would be my choice. And obviously the Balfour Declaration, I mean, Tom, you know, hugely consequential.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question for you, Tom. It's about texts. It's from Capitanilli again, I'm afraid. A repeat questioner.
So Capitanilli's having a great episode.
Yeah. Yeah, come from nowhere in recent weeks. So how often are previously unknown or lost ancient texts rediscovered? What was the last notable discovery? And do you believe there are any major texts that still exist waiting to be rediscovered? Or have we found what there is to be found?
Well, texts are always being found. They're very rarely complete, but definitely fragments of texts are being dug up, particularly in rubbish dumps in Egypt, where the conditions preserve papyri.
Right.
You know, there are large collections that were, say, brought back. The Oxyrhynchus hoard was brought back to Oxford, and there's still lots there to be sifted. But kind of fragments of Gospels, little fragments of Sappho or pieces of Euripides, you know, they turned up over the past decade. I think, it's a good question. I think the last major complete text to turn up was Cicero's Republic, which was found in the archives of the Vatican in the mid-19th century. And I would guess that the likeliest place for a significant text to be found would be in the archives of a major collection like that.
Really? Through lack of resources not being properly catalogued or something?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's a slight issue that the British Museum have had with some of their collections, that they're so large and so old that the cataloguing that was done, you know, in, I don't know, 1780, doesn't really measure up to the cataloguing standards that one would have now. And it could just be, I don't know, something from Mantua or something might be on the list.
Yeah.
And nobody really knows what that something from Mantua is, but it might be a long lost copy of the lost books of Tacitus or something. And the other famous, so there are palimpsests, which are texts that have been erased and then written over again. So I think a text of Archimedes was found quite recently. It was on a piece of parchment that had been scrubbed clean and a new text written over it. And of course, there's the text in the library at Herculaneum that's, you know, the roll, the scrolls, which is an enduring ambition to be able to decipher them. I think the science isn't quite up to it yet, but there is a sense that it might be fairly soon.
And one last question, Tom, before we wrap, which is if there was one thing we know existed, but we don't have, that could be found, if you could have your dream discovery, what would it be?
A work of history or classical text generally?
Classical text generally.
I think some of the lost tragedies, whether of Aeschylus or Sophocles or Euripides, would be amazing.
You'd rather that than like the lost books of Tacitus or something?
I think so. I think it would be amazing to have more plays by Aeschylus.
Okay, very good. All right. So just to keep everybody posted.
Actually, Dominic. Just going back to that, maybe the poems of Sappho, complete poems
of
Sappho.
Okay, that's a nice answer. So just to keep everybody posted on what is happening, we are doing a live stream on Monday the 16th, aren't we? Subject to be determined. That will be in the week where we finish the Baghdad series. We'll then have two episodes on Captain Cook, will then be into the series about Cortez and Montezuma. And we will, of course, be appearing live in Bath on the 23rd of October, in London, in Hammersmith on the 31st. I think we've now sold something in the region of 3,000 tickets for that. So there probably are only a very few left. And then we will be heading to Australia. But for those of you who are not in Australia, we will be with you, Tom, to the miracle of technology with Young Napoleon and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And then we will be into such things as the Peasants' Revolt, Chaucer, and the fall of Richard II. So lots of really interesting things to come.
Lots to look forward to. And just to say, if you are tempted by any of the live shows that we're doing, whether in Bath or in London or in New Zealand or Australia, we have been working on those shows, haven't we? And I think they'll be quite fun.
Ah, then they will be fun. Well, I mean, it'd be terrible if they weren't.
Are we allowed to say what they're going to be about?
No.
Do you think we should keep it a secret?
We should keep it a secret. But they're an unexpected subjects that we have not done before. There will be swords, writes Theo. Oh, my goodness.
There will.
Yeah. We'll be reenacting the Battle of Bannockburn.
And possibly masks.
Right.
Who knows?
Okay. We will see you next time. Goodbye. Enjoy your holiday, Tom.
Thank you. It's not a holiday. It's hard work. Bye-bye.